to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's episode is entitled Mundane Malevolence. We're going to be talking about films that contemplate the mundane, the everyday, the suburban, the boring, I suppose. But they all have, it's quite an interesting coincidence in a lot of films that kind of hone in on the suburban and the everyday and the mundane. They all have some shocking degree of injustice or major immoral act or acts that kind of either permeate the storylines or sort of taint the purity of the situations that are being depicted in the film. And it kind of makes sense in a way, because you don't want to just look at a blank canvas for 2 hours. You want a big splotch of black paint on it, something like that, in terms of a sort of a cinematic, for sort of cinematic reasons to keep your audience entertained. But if we think about it on sort of a more philosophical level, it does kind of make sense the deeper we get into each of these films as to why there is sort of an inherent evil or an inherent sense of injustice or immorality in all the given scenarios and in which we find ourselves on the screen this week. But it is two very opposing ideas, isn't it? You know, something that's very boring being matched up with something that's very immoral or unjust. And I want to kind of remind you, dear listener, we've kind of touched on this a few times on the show. We talk about it happens a lot in films, particularly around about war, but this the kind of the adjacency between the civil and the uncivil, or the violent and the peaceful. Films like Thin Red Line, Come and See, recently talked about A Hidden Life, and how it kind of goes in another Terrence Malick film. And it almost as if to say that a lot of filmmakers over the years have tried to remind us that just because you feel like you're in a state of peace or civility or comfort doesn't mean that just around the corner something terrible is going to happen. It's almost like, you know, there's a real urgency from filmmakers and artists broadly, I suppose, to remind us that just because we feel comfortable doesn't mean there aren't terrible things happening in other parts of the world, or even just around our corner that could rear their head very soon. And it's kind of promoting the idea of not becoming complacent in fighting against injustice and making sure that we don't just keep ourselves focused on our own situation. But let's get into this a bit better. Let's talk about the films themselves. The first one is going to be, of course, Chantal Ackerman's very, very famous film from 1975, Jean Dillemin 23, Quai du Commerce, 1080 Brussels. Of course, we're going to talk about this one if we're talking about boring films. Very recently, was it last year or the year before, voted Sight and Sound's number one film of all time. A little bit shameful that we haven't talked about it sooner on the show. We're then going to move on to Little Children, directed by Todd Field, from 2006. We're going to finish up with the recent film by Jonathan Glazer, The Zone of Interest, which has got a lot of Oscars heat about it moving forward. But let's get started now with Chantal Ackerman's Jean Dillemin. So this is a very famously long and boring film. It goes for over 3 hours, and we pretty much just see a very nice a lady with a great routine, Jean, peeling potatoes, making dinner for her son, and kind of doing just everyday chores for 3 hours. And it's sort of a very provocative movie in one sense. And I remember when it was voted number one film a couple of years ago, just the internet comments gone crazy. I'm like, yeah, like I get the point of this film, but how is it number one? But let's not ignore the fact that it isn't simply just a compilation of scenes of, you know, mundane domestic scenes. It's laced with slight, I mean, it is a great film. It is top of the list in terms of, it does need to be mentioned in that kind of top 10 arena, I think, at all, because it just in terms of how it uses the form, at least the first film to actually do this and manipulate the form, the film form, in a very original and very provocative and very insightful way. It is laced with slight changes throughout Jeanne's day, in her routine, and also a fairly major plot point that rears its head very occasionally in the film, but when it does, it's very important, particularly at the end of the film. And I want to talk about it through this lens of how it so effectively explores this idea of how vulnerable we are to our attention. And what I mean by we, I mean human beings, even though I know this is a very feministic film, and it's very much about the plight of women, and, you know, it's a film from 1975, and it's very much connected with feministic cinema, but I want to talk about this week in terms of how, just on a broader level, how vulnerable we are to our attention being manipulated. So on a very simplistic level, as I kind of mentioned before, we can see this is simply a film from the 1970s, which simulates a domestic housewife's life to show audiences how monotonous that is, and, you know, to appeal to their empathy and make them feel sorry for women who have to spend all their time at home looking after, you know, making dinner and doing boring domestic tasks. But I think, and I think this is very much aided by watching it in the 21st century. I don't think we could ignore sort of a more, I'm not going to say more important aspect, for, but sort of a deeper aspect of this film that I think almost goes against this idea of how sort of terrible it is to be stuck at home. And it's important that we mention, you know, I think from a 21st century perspective, I think the 21st century perspective is really interesting in the sense, and I'll get into it in a second, but there's another really important aspect of the film, which is that we can, in sitting with this woman for 3 hours, we can be drawn into appreciating the minutiae of everyday life. Now, I know that's not the central intention of the film, and it's not the usual way that people watch this film, but just bear with me for a second. So when we begin to appreciate some of the minutiae in this life, so like just speaking personally, there are little aspects of this film that, you know, I've only seen this film once. I only first saw it very recently, but I didn't find it boring. It didn't appeal to that sense of me that was like, oh, isn't that terrible that a person has to live such a boring life? I didn't find it dreadful in the sense that nothing much happened. I think rather quite the opposite happened, which is that because of the way, you know, the way that the film recalibrates your attention by slowing time down, and this is something that Ackerman has actually spoken about in interviews to a degree, so it's not that hot a take, I'm conscious of this, but we do kind of, you know, by recalibrating our attention and drawing out the degree to which we're attentive to certain aspects of the film over the course of 3 hours, certain little aspects of what she does become a little bit scintillating. They become a little bit stimulating. And so it's not so much that just her character is drawn into this world, but us as an audience realize that we can be very drawn into small little incidental little tiny domestic things, just because that's the way our brain acts, right? When you take your phone away and put it away, your brain doesn't turn off. You find something in the room, some kind of sound, something to, you know, to click a pen. You find something to lock into and find interesting. And this is why I say that I think this film has kind of this second life in the 21st century, where we're, particularly in like the 2020s, where we're starting to reflect on the destructive elements of overstimulation. So we've got things like the rise of like meditation, transcendental meditation, or self-care, breathing exercises. If you go on YouTube, you can find lots of atmospheric and purely aesthetic sound and landscape. So you know, Jean Dillman compared to those things is a riot, right? There's a lot more going on in that film than if you just put on one of those 10-hour hip-hop, lo-fi study session things on YouTube. And there's also a lot of scenes in this film where she's eating and her and her son are eating. And like in the age of mukbang, like that's not that uneventful for us in the 21st century. But don't get me wrong, the film is clearly not a joyous celebration of this. It's an adventure in realizing, or I think it best serves us in the 21st century, or best serves me, if speaking subjectively, that as we always do on the show, if that wasn't clear. It's an adventure into realizing, or an encounter in realizing how easily both the character and us as the audience can be lulled into the mundane, right? That we are very susceptible, very vulnerable to being lulled into a very mundane life and locking in on something that really is, in the broad scheme of things, very insignificant, and forgetting the greater sort of global and existential aspects of our existence that we perhaps should at least give some thought to. And the film goes further than that as well, because we have this, I don't want to give away too much in case anyone hasn't seen the film, and I think everyone should watch this film, but there's an aspect of this film, a very important plot point that, you know what I'm talking about, if you've seen the film, that does sort of make her life a little bit less mundane. And I think the way that the film depicts that in this context of being lulled into the mundane is that if one is lulled in too deep to the domestic, to the mundane, to the insignificant, you can't help but feel there's going to be, almost in like a Marxist sense, there's going to be a sort of explosive kind of huge sort of zero sum or net negative, at the end of the day, kind of an ultimately destructive or nihilistic kind of revolution to produce from that. If you put enough pressure on a single thing and push it down and to make it feel really, really, really small, it's going to eventually spring back in a very explosive and destructive way. And you know, we could talk about how this film maybe advocates for a more meaningful dialogue between opposing forces in society to avoid sort of an explosive response, an explosive revolution. People in power, you know, it's in people, powerful people's interests as much as in for the those that it is empowered to make sure that transitions of power happen sort of gracefully, and that we take care of people in a much more kind of measured way, rather than just constantly putting pressure on someone and having to force them to spring back quite violently. But despite our vulnerability to being lulled in that way, and I'm not denying that we can be easily lulled in, because I was very much lulled in watching the film, surely we can't miss all of the world's injustices when they do rear their head, right? But before we move into our next film, which explores that idea, just a reminder that you are listening to Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio, and stay tuned for more quality radio content here on 2XX if you're listening live. And if you're listening online, be sure to subscribe to the station or sponsor the show. We'd very much appreciate all of that. That wouldn't be malevolent or mundane. That'd be exciting and admirable. But moving on now to Little Children, directed by Todd Field from 2006. In terms of a brief synopsis, if you haven't seen this one, Kate Winslet is like a new mum who is kind of out of place as a classic suburban mum. And as a result of this, I suppose, she sort of gives into what is ostensibly an immoral yet very liberating temptation. And in the background of this, we see, I guess what you could say, sort of the plight of this local pedophile who in an interesting way, you could sort of say we could ascribe some of the same attributes to him that we ascribe to Kate Winslet, but he's in a much more extreme example, and we're much more acute to his, his immoral acts, because they're a bit more extreme, let's say. And I want to talk about how this film sort of, you know, as opposed to something like Jean Dillman, he talks about the kind of constantly apparent presence of immorality. You know, while we can be lulled into, you know, just focusing on little, small, insignificant things, when immorality is around us, it's kind of hard to ignore. It's kind of obvious, and not just around us, but in us. So on paper, right, if you think about going back to, you know, Kate Winslet's situation, she's a new mum and she's living in American suburbia, and she's not cut out to be a suburban mum. She's a creative and interesting person with a master's in English literature. We can't help but think that on paper, this story almost should be very similar to Jean Dillman, because it's got the same kind of attitudes towards female liberation and that sort of thing. But when you watch this film, it feels completely different. It's a completely different kind of film. It's so much more American and dramatic and colourful and action-filled, right? And so I think you could almost describe this film as like if you started a lot of other films of its generation, or at least just before it. So kind of starting with something like Blue Velvet in the 80s by David Lynch, but then moving on through the 90s with things like Donnie Darko, American Beauty, and then into the 2000s, they've got like a TV show like Desperate Housewives. We almost had through the 90s, I know Blue Velvet's 80s, but I think it was sort of the first one to do this, and then the rest kind of followed suit 10 years later. A lot of films, particularly in the 90s and early 2000s, we were so obsessed with suburbia, particularly sort of like the hidden horrors that hide behind the facade of the white picket fence and all the terrible things that are going on. And I think by the time you get to the mid-2000s, into the late 2000s, you know, 2006 when this film comes out, we can just start from the middle. We don't have to sort of say, hey, you'd think that, you know, even though these houses look like they're, you know, there's all these primrose and green lawns, you wouldn't believe what's behind all of this. I think this film kind of just from the gates is like, well, we all know that there's stuff going on in suburbia. We don't have to pretend it's a mystery. And it's kind of like out of the gates. And from the first scene of the film, we know that there are dangerous people that live in these supposedly safe havens in the US, you know, suburban world. And so it's almost like this film's kind of assuming from the very beginning we're actually very aware of the drama in suburban life. We can't help but find it. So, like, even if you think about, like, Think about, like, you know, stereotypical chattering housewives. Like, they gossip. There's drama everywhere you look. If you want it to be, if you think about something like a PNC, or I guess in America they call them PTA groups and PTA meetings. Like these big fish in small ponds that'll find someone to make a villain out of. You know, they'll find some problem with the school that they've got a, you know, recently at Newington in Sydney, for example, people are protesting it's going COVID. Like if you put a big fish in a small pond, they're going to find drama. They're going to find some apparent injustice. It reminds me a little bit of what we said about Taxi Driver all those years ago, and we did that episode. We called it Boys. It was called Boys Gone Wild. And we talked about how a taxi driver lifts up this idea of, if you want to, you can find injustice anywhere you want to find it, right? And I think this film is really clever in how it depicts the idea that, you know, in being able to sort of find injustice wherever we want, and in injustice almost gives us license to enact our power, enact our influence, to a degree, enact our identity in the world, and have it realized by the surrounding world. You could say that a lot of the characters almost become quite addicted or obsessed with fighting the apparent immorality in their ostensibly boring suburban American towns. And so the PTA-like group in this film, which is the one who drives around going after and putting posters up about the pedophile character, becomes so, we sort of see the archetypal arc of that self-righteous character becoming so power-obsessed, becoming so obsessed with achieving justice, a bit like in like Snowtown, but that's been a much more extreme example than this one. But I did think about it a lot watching this film, is that that group becomes so power-obsessed that it begins to eat its own tail. The ends don't justify the means. It's so obsessed with enacting moral behaviors and performing moral behaviors and promoting morality or conventional morality in the world, that it's so obsessed, extremist about that, that it actually brings about sort of moments of immorality and unjustness. So you could say the film goes so far as to say that we almost become crippled by our acuteness and judgment of the surrounding world, or at least some of us can be almost crippled by the acuteness and judging the surrounding world, and eventually ourselves. So we can't avoid the fact, at least the more perceptive ones in us, and maybe for the less perceptive ones it takes a little bit more time, but by the end of this film, every character has had some moment of self-reflection where they realize that they themselves are immoral, they themselves are unjust, and it's very hard to point fingers everywhere, and you realize that you could point a finger literally anywhere to find injustice, even in a small suburban town where nothing happens, let alone in a big wide world where there are things like wars and genocides and all sorts of things happening in the wider world. Like we talk about a lot on this show that if you put a film in an extreme setting or use an extreme character, it means you can speak a lot to everything on the other side of that. So we often talk about that with heroes and things like that. You know, if an extremely strong person is susceptible to something, that means we're kind of all susceptible to that sort of thing. We talk about that a little bit when we talk about Napoleon, but this one as well. If something as mundane or banal as an American suburbia can be this riddled with injustice, sure as hell can be sure that the rest of the world is riddled with injustice. And I think Field is kind of, not to draw too long a bow here, but I think this is something that Fields also explores quite well in Tar, which we have talked about on the show before, which is also kind of this idea that you know, we it almost goes as far as to say that the immorality is so like inherent in all of us, right? From the least famous to the most famous, from the least talented to the most talented, that we almost can become too sensitive to immorality for our own good. Like we begin to eat our own tails, so to speak. Like you if you are going to jump on immorality everywhere you can possibly find it, you're going to particularly find it in prominent figures in society because we see so much of them. And then if we're going to do it so devoutly and so dogmatically, well, we're just going to eat our own, you know, the leaders of our society, as we see with, you know, cancel culture and, you know, how many prime ministers have been overturned in Australia of late or in the UK, and how polarized the American situation is. If we do look, and I'm not saying that immorality doesn't exist in these people, it's more the opposite, that there's so much immorality, there's so much we could say that's bad about a person, we can be so critical about anything, that no one can survive if we're that devout or that dogmatic about, you know, with our moral judgments. And it is interesting, because in a way it kind of leaves us with this impression, and particularly at the end of the film, it does kind of leave us with the impression that maybe, you know, rather than jumping on each other's backs, it's just going to be more effective to kind of just get started helping our enemies become better people rather than constantly fighting them and telling them they're bad people, which is a really interesting thing to contrast with Jean Dielman, which is, as I said, you know, like a 70s feministic film, where little people, you know, when we talk about the idea of feminism specifically, little people, like, almost makes an effort in 2006 to expressly subvert classical ideas about feminism. Particularly in the same way Kate Winslet talks about Madame Bovary and how, you know, her English lecturers at college would consider her crazy for calling Madame Bovary a feminist figure. And we can debate, I haven't actually read Madame Bovary, so I can't speak about that in any great detail, but we can have a debate about the degree to which that statement she makes is true or false. But the fact that she makes it, I think, is really interesting to contrast with Jean Dielman, that we have a classic sort of feminist viewpoint in that film, and then this one is almost expressly saying in 2006 that we need to subvert our ideas around what is feminism, just as a little microcosmic example of how these two films interact. So on one hand, we do have to accept that, you know, our attention can be so vulnerable to manipulation, to social conditioning, to you know, powerful hegemonic ideas, that we can be very easily lulled into a state where we can only focus on small minutiae things, and we can't focus on anything as systemic, anything big that's really holding us down that we don't even realize. But on the other hand, injustice is so ever present, and we are really a lot of us are very acute to it, especially when you see it everywhere. You know, it's not only always around us, but it's always within us, and we can ascribe that to everyone, including our leaders who are the masterminds, who are the puppeteers of these sort of broader systemic ideas. So which is right? What's the interpretation that we're supposed to take here? Well, let's finish off now with Jonathan Glazer's new film, The Zone of Interest. And in terms of a brief synopsis, it follows a traditional German family who's living in this kind of nice house in Poland post Nazi invasion. And I don't want to give too much away. I think people know what this film is about, but I basically want to say that they're kind of blind to a very obvious injustice happening in Poland, in a specific part of Poland at that time. And I want to talk about how this film, you know, just to sum up the sort of contradictory ideas between Jean Dielman and little people, little children. The title of today's episode is Mundane Malevolence. I think the beauty of Zone of Interest here is that it pretty much tells how mundane malevolence is, or basically kind of depicts injustice as mundane. They're almost synonymous in a way, or it's a central attribute of injustice that it is mundane. So if we look at the film and the life of the characters in the film, it's ostensibly a very boring and mundane movie, right? I mean, there's kind of minimal character development. Nothing crazy really happens to the characters. There's not too much music. They're kind of living a pretty fairly domestic life. So, I mean, this is completely on paper, Jonathan, if you're listening. But seriously, I mean, speaking of sort of interacting with this, with the film, sort of, you know, past the fourth wall kind of thing, the guy behind me was fully snoring in the film, like he fell asleep in the movie. But that, I think, added to the film when you think about what it's actually about. And you know, speaking of, you know, how we can relate with Jean Dielman in that way, I think there's a lot of connections between the two films. But despite the fact that it's sort of a bit boring on paper, there's an undeniable presence of injustice throughout the film, in that the people live next door to Auschwitz, which is the most infamous concentration camp of the Holocaust. And throughout all these seemingly mundane scenes, people are screaming in the background, and you see body parts floating through the river that they're swimming in, and there's plumes of ash floating up in the background behind all these shots of kids playing in a garden and that sort of thing. So I guess to sort of look at those two ideas together, we kind of like to think that injustice would be apparent to us, and we would just stand up and do something if something as sort of terrible as the Holocaust was happening right under our nose. But the truth is, life, particularly on the scale of the suburban, you know, on the everyday, on the scale of the everyday, is pretty eventful on a micro level, right? Like, someone does have to, you know, make sure that, even if you are living next door to the Holocaust, or you're living next door to systemic gender injustice, or you're living next door to any kind of injustice on a systemic level, you still need to iron your clothes, you still need to organize your meals for the week, you still need to dress the children and that sort of thing. And even on a deeper level, and I think this is kind of my favorite aspect of this film, Zone of Interest, is that you have some pretty dramatic, like, acts of immorality happening in your own personal life, even if you are in a kind of idyllic German family. Like the husband and wife have a really interesting dynamic in this film that juxtaposes kind of the purity that Nazism dared to promote or claim to promote. And I think we don't have time to go into it, but I think this film is a really interesting example of how that depicts the parallel state of the world and the individual, where the state of the individual sort of parallels or mimics the state of the world at that time, where, you know, and particularly the idea of, you know, keeping things pure and having sort of being pure of character and being a sort of a traditionally good German man. And you know, the fact that the Nazis were very well dressed and they're very, you know, pressed and they're very organized and everything like that, but they were doing unspeakably horrific things to other people. And the same with these characters in the film, you know, they get up early and they do all the business, but then they do some really terrible, like the worst thing you can do in a marriage, and they go back, go to sleep, get showered, wash off, it's all fine. Like, I think there's a really interesting parallel story happening there. And of course, saying all this, that our lives are eventful on the micro level, they're eventful, and that means it's hard to sort of act and to fight against injustice. That's not by any means me saying that that's an excuse for not doing anything, but rather this film is powerful in illuminating this glaring problem, which is that we tend to focus only on our immediate, I'm going to say it, zone of interest, rather than broader, more global zones of interest. And I guess in summation, what we could say about the film is that the life of those committing, the life of those who committed the great injustices of the past do look pretty similar, pretty much exactly the same to our modern day, everyday existences. I mean, you know, minus phones and PlayStations and things like that. You know, the Nazis ate breakfast, lunch and dinner. They ironed their clothes. They went to the shops. They went for a swim in the river. All the things, 99% of the things that they did and the things that we do are exactly the same. So the fact that we don't see, you know, bombs on battlegrounds next door and that sort of thing doesn't mean that we're not interwoven into broader unjust states of affairs. So what are we to do about all this? Well, let's try and tie everything together. So we've kind of talked about how, in the first place, that we are very susceptible to having our attention molded and conditioned to only focus on the menial, the small, and the domestic, and it keeps us under the thumb of broader ideas. And if we're pushed down that much, you know, for so long, eventually we'll snap. It's a very long road down to that point, 3 hours of a movie worth. But let's not kid ourselves, all right? Injustice can be a very loud and present thing, not only in our neighborhoods, but in our own lives, right? We deal with things like guilt and shame and hatred of ourselves and hatred of others on an everyday basis. It's not like that we're completely unaware that there are terrible things happening in ourselves and in the lives of people around us. But perhaps in order to sort of reconcile both of those seemingly conflicting ideas, in the rub, it's kind of like injustice is not something like, it's not something that only appears, as I said before, sort of like in stereotypical settings like battlegrounds or in a boxing ring or something like that. You know, the presence of routine and habits doesn't necessarily, you know, vaporize foreign or even close to home injustices, right? The fact that life might look normal doesn't mean that terrible things aren't happening next door a bit further down the street. So maybe it's important that we don't just gloss over the injustices of the day, right? Maybe we need to sort of see, you know, maybe we shouldn't just see the evils of humanity, both in the past and present, as things that are just to be spectated, just the things to be looked at in a faraway land when you're on holiday as a tourist or something like that, or through a piece of glass. Rather, maybe we ought to start acknowledging our evil sides every day and our malevolence in the mundane. That's all we've got time for this week here on Sacred Cinema, here on 2XX98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in. Once again, returning listeners, and if you're a new listener, thanks so much for joining us. Get in contact with me by emailing me at contact@jimmyburnascone.com. But stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX, or jump onto our website to consider subscribing or sponsoring the show. But until next week, have a good one. Cheers.